Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Black History Month, focusing on the contributions of the nearly 1 million African-American men and women who served in our then-segregated armed forces during World War II. Among them were many whose names we know now because of their athletic achievements. The legendary boxer Joe Louis volunteered for the Army just a month after the attack on Pearl Harbor. If you ever visit Arlington National Cemetery, you will see Joe Louis's grave prominently featured there. Jackie Robinson, who would go on to break baseball's color barrier, had a well-documented stint in the Army during World War II, including his courageous stand against discrimination on a bus in Texas during the war. Larry Doby, the first black player in the American League, served in the Navy in World War II, following in the footsteps of his father, who had served in World War I. But often underneath the story we have heard lies one that we may not have heard. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you may remember that one of Larry Doby's Negro League teammates, Monty Irvin, was actually offered the distinction of becoming the first African-American in the majors, and the reason it did not unfold that way goes back to his Army service in World War II. Born in Alabama as one of 13 children in a family with legendary athletic talent, Monty Irvin grew up in New Jersey. And how about this? While playing college football, he actually moonlighted as a professional baseball player in the Negro Leagues, playing only road games under the pseudonym Jimmy Nelson so his double life would not be uncovered. True story. Irvin's experiences in barnstorming tours with major league stars made it clear that the players in his league could hold their own, but baseball's color barrier was still there.
Well, we were disappointed, and we made some friends with some of the major leaguers, and we told them, we said, why don't you guys talk it up? You know, maybe we could help him win a pennant or a World Series. So they said, well, we'll do what we can, but you know how negative the owners are. I said, well, keep talking, because it's bound to happen one of these days. And sure enough, in 1946, Bob Feller, one of my dear friends, he formed an all-star team, and Satchel Paige formed an all-star team, and they played each other. They broke about even, but it showed everybody, you know, including the scouts, that we could play baseball as well as anybody. All we needed was a chance. And after that, the scouts out there looking for talent signed a lot of the African-American players.
Now, you at one point left the Negro Leagues and went to the Mexican League, won a triple crown there. But I understand, with all the great hitters that you could have looked at to model your game after, it wasn't someone in your league, but it was an Italiano wearing pinstripes that you modeled your swing after. Is that true?
That's true. Joe DiMaggio. I saw him when he broke in with the Yankees in 1936. I was hitting the ball well, but I wasn't hitting the ball a lot to right field, so I wanted, you know, being a right-handed hitter, I wanted to pull the ball, so I used to go there and watch him, and he was a dead pull hitter, and how quick he was, you know, when he was getting the bat around with his follow-through, and how graceful he looked at the plate and so on. So in 39, when I went to Daytona Beach for spring training, I practiced hitting the way he did. And by the time spring training was over, I had it. And from 39 on, I became a pretty good hitter, I tell you.
Well, yeah, 422 is pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was tough to strike out. I was strong, you know, naturally strong. And all I needed to do was just get that bat around a little quicker. And with the Joe DiMaggio stance, and the fact that you didn't stride very far, maybe 4 or 5 inches, you could judge the ball, and see the ball, and be in position to hit a curveball, changeup, or a fastball. So it didn't take me long to copy Joe. Later on, I told him about it. He said, "Well, I'm glad somebody thought enough of me to copy my style."
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked pretty well for you, too.
And guess what? Willie Mays did the same thing.
Hey, there you go. Everyone seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Yep. Do you remember how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Standing on second base in Puerto Rico.
Really?
When they announced that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and the people started to cheer. So I said to myself, I said, they don't know, you know, what a big problem that's going to be, because everything that came into Puerto Rico came in on a ship. You know, the rice and the beans and everything else. And then 3 weeks, everything, rice and beans tripled. The price of rice and beans tripled down there. And so I definitely will remember, you know, being on second base when I heard that this disastrous thing has occurred.
Yeah, not many people can claim that they were standing on second base at the time.
Yeah.
And then Uncle Sam would get his hands on you. What did it mean to you when you were drafted and you realized that you're going to have to put baseball on hold and go serve?
I did. I had just left Mexico, you know, of the MVP down there. But I knew that, you know, you had to go. I had a daughter who was only 6 months old. I didn't want to leave her and my wife. But, you know, Uncle Sam called, saying we had to go. I was drafted, spent my training in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after about 6 weeks, went on down to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And then in a few months, we caught the a troop ship going to England. It was in the North Atlantic for 19 days, and the North Atlantic can be rough, even in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's almost impossible. And so in 19 days, we were on that ship in a convoy of 500 ships. And guess what? We didn't lose one ship out of a convoy of 500. But when we got to Liverpool, we couldn't stand up because of that rocking and roll. Yeah, that was a funny thing.
That would do it to you. And much like baseball was segregated at the time, the military was segregated at this time. And
yeah,
so you were in
tragic.
The 1313th Engineer General Service Regiment?
Yes, uh-huh.
With all African-American soldiers?
Yeah, uh-huh. At the beginning, we had a white officer, and later on, he was replaced by an African-American CO, and then we got two or three other lieutenants. You know, we felt, you know, more comfortable, and it was treated a little better. So during... In 1944, after they invaded, June 6, 1944, was D-Day. But we didn't get there until 2 months later. And when we got there, Omaha Beach had been cleaned up. After staying around the beach for a while, we moved across Paris and settled on the other side. And then mainly our duty then became guard duty. A lot of the Nazi soldiers had surrendered, and there was a problem because there were so many of them. We had it was a chore trying to keep track of all of them. So that's what we mainly did until the war was over in Japan.
Now, I did read that your unit, during the Battle of the Bulge, that your unit was assigned not necessarily on the front line, but in reserve and near Reims, France.
That's true.
In the Meuse line and ready to blow up bridges if the order came.
Yeah, we blow up bridges and doing a lot of guard duty of refineries, because we knew that the Nazis needed fuel. A whole outfit was guarding the fuel depots, and luckily they stopped them, up at the Battle of the Bulge, and they never did get to Reims. But Reims was only about 60, 70 miles away, and if they had broken through, there was going to be some heavy fighting in and around Reims, France. We're so happy that it didn't happen.
Now, I've read before, and I've interviewed several African-American veterans from World War II who told me about how they were treated overseas and then how they were treated back in the States. Did you notice a difference, and did that time overseas give you a new perspective?
Yes, it did. We were treated better by the natives, by the English and the French and then people from Belgium. We had a lot of problems with our own soldiers. Mainly, why they wanted to, be so anti, we just couldn't understand it. And then after we came back here, back to the States, we were scorned also, and we couldn't understand why. We were called on to do a job, and we did it. But seemingly nobody appreciated enough. To welcome us back home.
Well, I'm sure. And on cold nights in France, in a foxhole, you probably weren't thinking I'm going to be a baseball Hall of Famer someday.
No, not at all. In fact, before it went over, I never thought that we'd ever get the chance to play in the majors.
Mm-hmm.
But after going, seeing how things were done over there and so on, some of the guys was very happy that they experienced a lot of freedom. And when we came back, the saying was, if they can fight for the country, why can't we play for them? So there was a move afoot, to get us into Major League. I remember Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia had a group, and he was, along with Adam Clayton Powell and some other politicians, had that in their minds to do it. But then Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, so that
Hold on there, because the way I heard it, Branch Rickey wanted to sign you.
He did, and I signed with him. I told him I'd had a hard time, didn't have a chance to play at all over there, and I said, I'll sign with you, but I'll let you know when I'm ready. He said, well, that's great.
And you had some ringing in your ears from all the artillery overseas?
Yeah, I had an inner ear problem. And 2 years, it got better. And then I started to play like I had been playing. And selecting Jackie, they picked a college-educated person who had gained publicity and notoriety out there at the UCLA. He starred in four sports. He was wasn't the best player, but he was the most adequate person that Branch Rickey could have taken. And then, lo and behold, Jackie improved every year. He became a clutch hitter. He became a real good second baseman. He became very thrilling on the bases. So it shows you that, how... I guess smart that Branch Rickey was by picking Jackie, and we're all grateful and very happy that he did such a great job of pioneering.
Oh, and it sounds like one of the reasons you said wait on me is you felt if you were the first one and you weren't 100% that you wouldn't have represented your whole league and whole race
True.
Of people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it worked out just the way it should have.
Worked out just fine. Jackie did a great job. You know, he passed away in 1972. Can't believe that he's been gone that long. But he did one super job. Had to take a lot, but he did. And we're, again, very grateful for the wonderful job that he did.
And did I interpret correctly when you talked about that you and other African-American veterans of the war who came back felt like what you did overseas and what you proved in doing so had a big role in your access eventually to Major League Baseball?
Yeah, yeah. I think what we did helped the cause, and again, I think it made it a little easier. They realized if given a chance, we could do it just as good as anybody else.
The most recent ripple of that point that was proven decades ago by Monty Irvin and the rest of those men, many of them World War II veterans who integrated Major League Baseball, was the decision just a couple of months ago to count statistics from the Negro Leagues as Major League records. Monty Irvin wasn't worried about statistics, even though his helped put him in the Hall of Fame. And when he wrote his autobiography, he took a departure from a quote from his New York Giants manager. Leo Durocher had famously said that nice guys finish last. The title of Monty Irvin's book?
Nice guys finish first.
And what was the point behind that? What did you try to convey with that
message?
That
you can still be, Leah would do anything to win. I wanted to do the right thing and still win, leave a wonderful legacy, in winning and winning the right way. I wanted to be remembered as someone who came up late, but did the very best I could do under very trying circumstances. I tried to make it better for those who came after me. I tried to show some class wherever I could. And more than anything else, my father told me, he said, Monty, all you have to do is treat people the way you want to be treated and live by the golden rule, and you'll be okay. So that's the legacy I'd like to leave.
And indeed it is, the legacy he left. Monty Irvin passed away in 2016. If you ever have the chance to visit the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, you can think of some of those words you heard when you take a look at his plaque, or maybe even when you see his retired number 20 displayed at a San Francisco Giants game. It is time for our final break, but when we come back, memories from another man who blazed quite a trail during World War II. Maybe blaze isn't the best word to use in this instance, because he would be fighting fires as a smoke jumper with the Triple Nickels. If you've never heard of the Triple Nickels, just wait a few minutes, because you'll hear from one when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.